Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in Northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. In the opening interview, we will be exploring Great Lake Island Escapes with author Maureen Dunphy. Then Upper Peninsula-based writer Ellen Airgood will be here to read from her new middle grade novel, The Education of Ivy Blake. I'll also be talking to children's writer Billow Smith and illustrator Glenn Wolfe about their new Christmas book, 4 a.m. December 25th. At the end, Fleta Brown will introduce us to the work of poet Ross Gay. I'm pleased to welcome Detroit-based writer Maureen Dunphy to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Maureen.
Thanks for having me, Aaron.
Maureen is a veteran writer who has successfully followed two career paths, one as a technical writer in the auto industry, and the second as a college instructor of creative writing. Today, we will be talking about her new book from Wayne State University Press, Great Lakes, Island Escapes, Ferries and Bridges to Adventure. You've taught fiction writing, and you've written fiction for many years. How did you arrive at this nonfiction book on islands?
Well, if I may, I'd like to read the first two paragraphs of the book and then explain how it's similar and how it's different from my fiction writing forays in the past. The book I'm holding in my hands was conceived during an impromptu happy hour on one of the best known of the Great Lake Basin Islands, Mackinac Island. After a day exploring the islands on rented bikes, my husband and I were relaxing on the porch of the Harbor View Inn bed and breakfast, enjoying goat cheese on crackers with a good Sauvignon Blanc we'd purchased up the street at Dowd's Market, the oldest family-owned grocery store in the United States. Having shown up for other reasons than for Michigan's Republican convention on the island, which was well underway at that time, we were indulging in some serious people watching as visitors to the island streamed by on Main Street. And I was trying unsuccessfully to imagine such a scene taking place on our island, Canada's Pelee Island, a rural island where at that point we'd owned a cottage for 15 years. How could two islands in the same freshwater system be so completely different? We poured another glass of wine and reminisced about the other islands in the Great Lake Basins we'd visited over the years. Belle Isle, Bablo Island, and Gros Isle in the Detroit River, Beaver Island in Lake Michigan, Manitoulin Island and Flowerpot Island in Lake Huron, South Bass Island and Kelly's Island, in addition to Pelee Island in Lake Erie. And that night, looking out our third floor window beyond the lights at the pier on Haldimand Bay to the Straits of Mackinac, I was remembering what very wonderful and very different adventures we'd had on the 10 Great Lake Islands we'd already visited. Could there be more islands to explore, ones that we'd missed? Surely there must be a book that would give me more Great Lake Island hopping ideas. I looked when we got back to the mainland, but I could find no such book. And so, Aaron, that's where the similarity between writing this nonfiction book on Great Lake Islands, writing the book that I wanted to read, which is exactly what it is, which is why it ended up the length that it did. This is the information, this is the book I would have liked to found when I went looking for it. And like a story or novel, it stuck in my head and I couldn't get rid of it. So this happy hour on Mackinac Island happened in September of 2009. The idea was stuck there in 2011 when I took 3 weeks off from a contract I had with Volkswagen as an instructional designer. And I went traveling around to see what islands nearby that were either day trips or overnights. Like, if I was going to write this book, what would I include? What would it be about? And it really, 2012, I wrote a book proposal, and 2013 and 14, I took the trips.
So there are 35,000 islands. How did you decide which islands to visit?
Yeah, that was a problem. So in the beginning, I thought, well, I better figure out exactly what the Great Lake Basin looks like. And I tried finding maps to figure out what islands I would go to. And that is when I discovered there were about 35,000 islands. So obviously, I wasn't going to go to all of them. I got a 1953 National Geographic map used online because many of the maps since the 50s only include the United States or Canada. They don't show the whole basin, and this was a great map. And I figured I'm not a boat person. I like to kayak, but I don't have a motorboat. I'm not interested in it, and I don't particularly like small planes. So I decided I would go to the islands that were accessible by ferry service or attached to the mainland by bridge. And I thought maybe I'd been to 10 of those before I had this idea. So I thought maybe there'd be 25. And then when I started finding them on the map, I thought, well, maybe there's 42. And the reason I remember these numbers is because I kept changing my computer password and embedding the number. So my password was GL Islands and then whatever number I was at. So it was 25, it was 42. Then for a while, it was 65, 72, 87. And my password to this day is 107, but I ended up going to 136 islands. And those were all of the islands that I could find that were accessible by ferry or bridge.
Now, these were not solo trips. Your journal excerpts, you mentioned traveling companions. With whom did you travel?
So initially when I took that pilot trip, I went by those pilot trips in 2011, I went by myself. And when I was working on the book proposal, part of a book proposal is to include a sample chapter, and I couldn't decide what chapter to include. We'd had this place on Pelee Island. So I actually wrote a sample chapter on Pelee Island. But ultimately, I decided what would be most impressive was to take an island that people didn't necessarily think was someplace to go for adventure. So I chose Gros Isle, which is sometimes considered just a downriver bedroom community. But actually, Gros Isle is very cool. And it happens that one of my best friends grew up on Gros Isle. So when I wanted to go back for my third trip to Gros Isle, I invited Val Overholt to come along with me. And we had such a good time. Now, this was in April. There was snow the day that we went.
So Gros Isle is in the Detroit River, just off Wyandotte.
Yes. So it's 25 miles from downtown Detroit. And we had such a good time that we actually went back the following Saturday, too. So we spent two Saturdays together. And what I noticed traveling with a friend was that two things happened. One, it was another pair of eyes to filter the island experience through and to talk it over. But the other thing was, when I was traveling by myself, whether I was talking to men or women or families, I think they might have been afraid I was going to sort of glom onto them. When I had another person with me, we both were asking questions and talking. It was a conversation. Nobody was afraid that I was suddenly going to become their best friend or try. And it was just much more, it was much easier, and it was a lot more fun. So I invited 24 women friends from all parts of my life to accompany me on trips. 20 agreed. And then the next year, I had discovered more islands and had more trips. So I invited five more women friends, and so my mom went on a trip with me, which was fun, and each of my daughters went. And it ended up being 27 trips to the 136 islands.
Now, as a technical writer, you're certainly well-versed in the research process. How did you employ that in researching for this book?
Yeah, so it was
as a reader, I'm knocked over by the detail that you provide.
Oh, well, thank you. Yes, I am a little obsessive compulsive, which is really helpful for this kind of project. There were really, I went in asking islanders two questions. One was, what do you think is special about your island? And the second question is, what would you especially want a visitor to be sure to see or experience while on your island? So by asking that question on every island that I visited, of as many people as would talk to me, I got some really interesting directions on what I needed to go see and explore and include in the book. I took a Canon PowerShot, a very small one that fit in my pocket, with the idea of taking as many photographs as I could to help me remember where I'd actually been and in what order. Because on some trips, I was going to, six, seven, 10 islands on one trip. And I didn't expect, or I would have perhaps taken a different camera, that in the end, the 115 photographs that are in the book are all mine that I took on that Canon PowerShot. There's only one picture in the book that is not mine. And then the other thing was I took a stenographer's notebook. So I was like being a journalist, which I'm not. And I kept very, very thorough travel journal. I was writing all the time. So I wrote on the ferries. I wrote occasionally while driving. I wrote any place that we stopped. And so when I went home from every trip, if I'd been to three islands, I had three notebooks full of travel journal. And that was really helpful. So my research process basically was that.
And then how did you decide with these, all of this material? How did you pare it down?
Yeah, well, that was a problem. Originally, this was going to be a 250-page maximum book. And like you said, it's over 400 pages. And I kept warning the press, I think this might be too long. And they kept saying, no, no, just do what you're doing, which I did. In the end, I had a pretty good format of what I wanted to include in each chapter. And I wanted to be balanced. So on some islands, there's a lot to see in all arenas of natural sites, history preserve, cultural attractions. And other islands you'd go to, like Grand Island or North or South Manitou, and you're basically having more of an outdoor adventure. You're hiking. And I should say that in the case of those type of islands, although you know perhaps that I'm an avid camper and have been for years, I only camped on North and South Manitou Island because I wanted to make these adventures accessible to the most people. And so I wanted to be not roughing it and hiking it as I might have chosen to do, but to have the situation where I was going as someone who was either taking a day trip or an overnight trip where I needed accommodations and checking it out that way.
Is there a story behind the watercolor maps that are positioned at the start of each of the 11 body of water sections of the book?
There is such a story, Aaron. So I really wanted for each section of the book, each of the lakes, each of the rivers or straits, to have a map that showed the islands that I'd been to. And I want it to be to look consistent. Like I wanted that look to be the same. And I could not find any such map where I could do that. And then the problem was maps, creating maps is a very big, intensive, both time and money-wise. My mom is a fine artist. She's had a studio and gallery in Northville, Michigan, Painter's Place, for over 40 years. And I asked her if she'd ever done any maps. And she actually had. She does house portraits on occasion, does some really interesting buildings, and at one point or another had done a map or two for someone who wanted to show someplace special to them. And I said, would you give it a try? And she had the idea to do it in watercolor. So we have the 11 original watercolors of the lakes. And then she darkened the islands. She included the islands on each lake and darkened the ones that I'd actually traveled to. So it became quite a fun project. We had to spend a couple days identifying what the press would be typesetting in terms of bodies of water, the name of the islands, the departure points from the mainland. And I can tell you that on December 26th, of this past year, we were proofreading all of those, which was a full day. But it's been a great project to have with my mom at this point in both of our lives.
Well, it's an impressive piece of work, and her paintings are wonderful.
Thank you.
Were there any islands that presented any particular challenges, or were there any misadventures? It's sort of hard to travel that much without having unexpected things happen.
Oh, there were unexpected things on every island, although I have to say that in all 27 trips, there was really only one island where I even had rain of any significance. And that was actually going back to Mackinac Island in mid-October, late October, so that was not unexpected. I think if I were to pick three islands that gave me a different sorts of challenges, the first is Isle Royale. And it's an odd thing, but I was actually afraid about going to Isle Royale, and it doesn't fit like with the rest of my personality or anything. But I don't like bears, so the first happy thought was that when I discovered there are no bears on Isle Royale, there are moose and wolves, and the wolves are very shy. And actually, now there's only two wolves left. At the time that I went there in 2013, there were 8 or 9 wolves on the island. Moose are fine if you don't get between them and their offspring. And I had no intention of doing that knowingly. And I don't know. The ferry ride was very long. I made the decision to go from Minnesota because although Minnesota is considered a Great Lakes state, right? Mm-hmm. The only island that Minnesotans can get to from their state by ferry or bridge is Isle Royale, despite it being a Michigan island, obviously. So that ferry trip was over 7 hours. But what was wonderful about it was the water was like glass when I went. It can be a horrible ride. And I'd read many adventures of people having horrible rides. The water was like glass the day that it was Vicki Brennan and I, a school board chum from long ago in Ferndale, who accompanied me on that trip. And the beauty of making that decision, which I could not have known at the time, Isle Royale is 45 miles long. And so when you go along a boreal forest coastline and bedrock cliffs for 45 miles, you get a real understanding of what wilderness is and how, although we don't see that certainly downstate at all, that is how we sort of, I think as humans, what we think of as wilderness, and to see 45 miles of it was just so impressive. And we went into Windigo, which is a very deep harbor, and to drop off some folks. And while we were there, I was just looking out and I said, is that a moose? And it was a moose with twin calves. And at that moment, they were in the water. It was very hot. They mm-hmm. were having record temperatures when we were there. And I fell in love with Isle Royale in the harbor going to Windigo. And I can't wait to get back.
It is a magical place.
Yeah.
So is that your favorite island or are there other islands?
Well, that ended up being my favorite. The other two islands that were challenges, which I sort of forgot about as we were talking because Isle Royale is magical, were Pelee Island because I've been going to for so long. Now we've been going there 23 years that I needed to make sure I could balance it and see it with new eyes, you know, not the person who was the cottager who knew it inside out from that perspective. And then the other island that was difficult was actually the original impetus for the project, which was Mackinac Island. So much has been written about Mackinac. People think they know Mackinac. So I had to find a different way. And going there in the end of October in rain and then realizing I needed to go to the interior of the island away from Main Street. So, you know, we started at the fort and went back and spent time with us in the cemeteries. And hiking was a whole different approach to Mackinac for me.
Now that you've gone through the islands, next projects? Are you going to continue with this or are you heading in a new direction?
Well, in terms of the islands and my future, I did a weekly blog this year from March through to September. And so I kept having fun with islands. I was doing a lot of book events on islands so I could sort of update, you know, my island bit and mention things that I didn't include in the book because I do not include things that might change like accommodations or restaurants. So I could pay homage to some of my friends, new friends on these islands through the blog. What I want to do with the islands is I actually want to go back to them. I want to camp on some of them that I would have loved to have camped on when I was there the first time. I actually have been back to over 10 islands since the book came out in June. And but no, I have another project and it's not about islands. But it is nonfiction of all things.
Can we have some parting thoughts on islands?
Yeah, I'll share the last couple paragraphs of the book. This is in the epilogue, which is entitled Ferrying to Island Time. You are on your way, and the island awaits you, regardless of what you will undoubtedly have forgotten to bring. You may have remembered to bring a camera, a notebook, a pen, but then you forget about the camera, the notebook, the pen, and simply watch the sunset over the water. You are here, now, on island time. It is windy or rainy, cold or hot. The ferry is rolling on dark waves, or heat shimmers above the glass of the lake's surface. Your bones adjust because adjusting is the only choice you are given. You packed your intentions and arrived clad in your control, and then you gave it all up when you bought your ferry ticket. You give over to island time. You have to cross the water, you need to pay more attention to the weather, and your choices are, at once, both more limited and more rich, like tea steeped one cup at a time. Once there, you may find you have fewer choices in food, clothing, plans. A welcome paring down. And with this comes the possibility for adventure in every meeting, at each intersection, with any shift in the weather. The basics of food and sleep take on more significance. Sleeping in a breeze, even when the mainland is hitting record three-digit temperatures with humidity. Cooking meals on a campfire or a cottage stove, or going out to a place where the island locals go to eat fresh fish just caught offshore, and to drink wine made from island grapes. On an island, you will often have the opportunity to walk back from your dinner to the place you will sleep that night, and you will take it. You may just find yourself singing aloud as you walk that gravel island road in the evening, whether you're alone, with a traveling companion, or accompanied by new island friends. As the engines cycle down and the ferry heads into the harbor, you find yourself anticipating the island you now will explore, note by note, while composing your own tune in island time.
If listeners would like to find out more information about your book, they should go to...
And go to my website at www.greatlakesislandescapes.com.
And the book again is Great Lakes Island Escapes. Maureen Dunphy, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Aaron.
It is with pleasure that I welcome Ellen Airgood to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Ellen.
Thanks, Aaron.
Good seeing you again.
It's great to see you.
Ellen is a resident of Grand Marais, Michigan, which is one of the most beautiful villages in our state.
It's a great spot. I'm very fortunate to spend so much time there.
You were here 4 years ago to talk about your debut novel, South of Superior. And since then, you've published two middle grade novels, Prairie Evers and The Education of Ivy Blake. Before we move to those, can we talk about your career a bit? You moved to Grand Marais, a number of decades ago?
You can go on ahead and say it. I moved to Grand Marais 25 years ago.
And that was shortly after you graduated from the University of Michigan.
About 2 years after, yes.
And you met and married a man and settled into a business.
I did. I married into the restaurant business. I had absolutely no idea what I was getting into.
And the restaurant, the West Bay Diner, is a very popular spot. And during the tourist season, you often work 80 to 100 hours.
That's true. We've this year tried to scale it back a little bit after 25 years for me and 35 years for my husband. We're getting a little older. But it's very consuming. A workday usually is anywhere from 10 is a light one to 15 is, you know. Yep, you work a lot. The food. Anyone who's in the food business is going to recognize this. It's labor intensive. It's got to be a labor of love or you won't keep at it for so long.
And in spite of that demanding workload and without a writing group or going off to get an MFA, you became a writer. How did that happen? How did you get started?
Oh, well, I think I must have maybe been born a writer.
Now, you grew up in the Thumb, right?
I grew up in the Thumb of Michigan. My parents had a small farm between Caro and Kingston. My father was a school teacher. My mother was a nurse. They both loved to read. Books were all over our house. And we didn't actually have a television until I was about 12. So reading was a big thing. I don't think it was any great philosophical reason. The family story was that the TV they had blew up one day when I was tiny, don't remember it, and Dad threw it out on the lawn and they just didn't get a new one for a long time. My grandparents had a television. They lived around the corner. It's not like I didn't see it, but whatever. We were readers. And In the fourth grade, I had a teacher, Mrs. Nora Keebler, who assigned a lot of creative writing. And that first assignment in her class was around October, as I remember it. And we wrote a short story, and I was hooked. I was just hooked. It hit me like a flash. This is what I want to do. And it also was the first time that I remember consciously getting it, that those books that I love to read, because I love to read, I mean, I read as a kid like voraciously, I still do, but those books that I so love to read were written by somebody, some person wrote them. I suddenly like saw behind the curtain. It had never dawned on me before. I just accepted them whole cloth. And then, so from then on, I wanted to be a writer. And it was never, it never faltered, that desire. I didn't actually study writing at University of Michigan. I have a degree in science, which I'm very glad of. But when I moved to Grand Marais, rather impetuously, at the age of 25, to get married, I decided to try again. So after a couple years there, I began writing seriously, and I spent probably 18 years working on a variety of things before my first novel came out.
And you weren't getting feedback from anyone at that point?
Not really. Somewhat. I wrote a novel. I can say in retrospect it was not very good at all. But I didn't know that, which is fine. And I sent out query letters and so forth the way that you do. And I did. I got some very kind feedback on it. I mean, I got all rejections. And even though I know that as a novel, it was just awful, it must have shown some writing promise in some way. So I wrote another book, and I got really nice rejections on that as well. And that a lot of that happened. But that was pretty much my feedback, was from editors or agents who took the time to say, you know, this book just doesn't work at all, dear, but you can write. And that was enough to keep me going.
Wow, that's a wonderful story.
That as well. And I have to say, I entered an essay contest, which was very pivotal for me in 1993. The Sierra Magazine had an essay writing contest every year. They probably still do. And I spent a couple of months working on an essay, and I sent it off. I can still see the pages on my dot matrix printer. And then the minute I sent it, I was horrified. I was like, oh, that was awful. That was just, why did I even send it? It's so embarrassing. And I think most writers will feel that way, maybe especially young writers, but any writer. There's a huge amount of insecurity being a writer, really putting yourself out there. But at any rate, I had already posted it out of the Grand Marais post office. It was too late to not do it. And I did think, well, I'm sure they'll get a lot of lousy entries, so whatever. But then I was one of the finalists. I was one of the winners, mm-hmm. which just blew me away. I truly did not expect that, but it was one of the biggest thrills of my adult life, certainly as my life as a writer. And it meant so much to me to be in a national publication like that. And it taught me something about believing your work is awful when maybe it really isn't. But the editor at that time, I think her name was Annie Stein, she called me on the phone, and I had no idea the call was coming. And I was in the restaurant, and I picked up the phone, and she said who she was and told me that I was one of the winners. And I remember saying, "You're kidding." And she just laughed. She said, "No, I'm not kidding. I wouldn't joke about something like this." So little things, it's pretty little, but it was huge to me, really meant they kept me going.
So how did you get an agent for South of Superior?
That's a great question. How did I get an agent for South of Superior? It was in the same way that you do, basically. I wrote many, many queries to many, many agents. And eventually I wrote to an agent who was interested enough to look at the work. That happened a number of times. I had some really nice rejections yet again, but this agent said, you know, this book is nowhere near ready to be published, but I definitely see something really special in it. So if you'd like to rework it, I would read it again. And my agent that I even did get, we went back and forth that way for a while. And eventually she said something like, I still hate the beginning and the end is terrible and the middle really isn't working at all, but I think we're almost there.
And she was eventually able to place that book, South of Superior, with Penguin.
Yes, another incredibly exciting moment for me in my writing life.
And it's hard to place a piece of literary fiction, which she successfully did.
She did. She's been a great She's been a great advocate for my work, and she did a great job of getting me a place at Penguin.
And since then, you've done two more books. They are middle grade novels. There's often some confusion on categories. What exactly is a middle grade novel, and who's the targeted audience?
So a middle grade novel is a novel that's being aimed at kids about 8 to 12 or 14 years old, basically middle school, you might think, range. That's the target audience, but in my own case, I can say that a lot of my adult readers have told me that they absolutely loved both of the middle grade novels. In the restaurant, when we sell them, we tend to say 8 to 108 because I think those categories, they're useful for marketing. They're absolutely necessary for it. And they definitely shape your work to some degree. There are things that aren't in The Education of Ivy Blake, for example, that would be if it were adult literary fiction. But nevertheless, so they're necessary, but they're a little false. A reader of any age might enjoy, as long as they're old enough.
And I have read both of those books. And they have the elements of fiction that pull you forward. They're just compelling stories.
Thanks.
Where the protagonist is greatly changed over the course of the book.
Thanks, Aaron.
So I don't quite understand the...
I think they need a way to... schools and libraries are huge markets for middle grade fiction. Maybe much more so than, random buyers or stores. So they need a way to group these books. They just need a way to classify them that will more or less work.
Ivy Blake, the newest of the books, is sort of based on some of the things that happened in Prairie Evers. Could you give our listeners some background on the Prairie Evers story and then how Ivy Blake becomes part of it without giving too much away?
Oh, that's a tough question. Well, first of all...
Just setting and character. And,
yeah, the first book, Prairie Evers. Prairie Evers is the protagonist. She's the narrator. It's told in the first person. She came to me actually many years before I wrote South of Superior. She came to me out of the blue as a voice talking in my head. And I at that point wasn't even planning to write a book, but her voice was so compelling that I wanted to, so I did. I did write down the things she was telling me, and I just did my best to follow her voice. And Prairie is a young girl, she's 10, who's moved from the mountains of North Carolina to a little farm in New York State, and she does not like it. She's going to public school for the first time. Prior to that, she had always been homeschooled, taught mainly by her grandmother. She does not want to go to public school, and she does not like it. But her grandma has moved back to North Carolina, feeling unable to deal with such a big move so late in life. So at any rate, she does go to public school, and she makes a big part of the story is the friendship she makes there with a girl named Ivy Blake. Prairie's family is awesome. They're warm, they're loving, they're creative, they're supportive. Ivy's family, not so much. So the heart of that book is about their friendship. And I think the question I was asking myself as I wrote was, what can you do for a friend who's in a bad spot? How much can you do? And how do you do it? And it also was about how that friend can have stuff to offer back to you even if they're in a much worse spot than you are. It was about friendship. It was about coping with change. So then, after Prairie came out, I was fortunate enough that my editor wanted another book. And the most compelling story that came to me at that time was more Ivy's story. What happens to Ivy after her friendship with Prairie? Ivy's mom is a troubled soul. And the book is about how Ivy comes to deal with that. It's about her love of art. She wants to be a filmmaker. It's about her mom's troubles and how they impact Ivy directly. It's about courage. Yeah, Ivy is about optimism. I say these things. I know I wrote the books, but the characters, when a book is working, come to seem like real people to me. Certainly, I direct their actions. I labor hard, harder than you might imagine, to come up with every single thing that happens to them, every move of the plot. I mean, I'm quite laborious. I try to make it not seem like that in the end. But I can't say, other than Prairie Evers, that book, the writing I do is not inspired. It's very workmanlike. But once things are up and running and kind of all the gears are fitting fairly well together, the characters become very real to me. So even though I created them, I don't feel like I created them. I feel like they're real spirits out and about in the world. So Ivy is a true hero to me, and she's a hero of mine. She is such an optimist when she has every reason not to be. And I could certainly take a page out of her book. And I remind myself of that now and then. Well, like, what would Ivy do?
Mm-hmm. That's great. Could you read a bit from The Education of Ivy Blake?
Sure. I'd love to. I thought I might read a chapter that's just a couple chapters in from the beginning. In the beginning, you're seeing Ivy living with the Evers family. She's been living with them for about 6 months as the new book opens. And she's very happy there. She's just had her birthday. It was great. They went to the movies. She loves movies. But she's concerned about the future. Mom Evers is going to have a baby. And Ivy's very aware, maybe much so, more so than most 11-year-olds, that the family isn't well off. She's a little concerned she's going to be a burden on them as another mouth to feed. And she's a little concerned that the excitement of a new baby will kind of maybe inadvertently push her out a bit. She's not sure. She's just not sure what all is going to happen. So this is just after her birthday, where they've shown her a very nice time and taken her to the movies. The title is Thunderstorm. A few nights later, rain drummed on the roof of the farmhouse. Thunder echoed off the mountainside, and every now and then a bolt of lightning flashed. Inside, everyone was sleeping. Even Pup, the cat, was curled behind Ivy's knees instead of stalking the mice that lived in the cellar. Pup purred, Prairie snored, and Ivy dreamed. She tensed and made a sound of protest. She tried to run and couldn't make her legs move. Something bad was happening, something terrible. She had to stop it. She woke up thrashing. Her heart pounded. Her nightgown was damp with sweat. "It's just a dream," Prairie mumbled. "It's okay." Ivy moaned softly. It seemed so real, like it was happening all over again. "Take deep breaths," Prairie counseled. Ivy did. "Think of something nice," Prairie murmured. Ivy's mind felt blank and frightened. "Want me to come down there?" "No," Ivy whispered. "I'm okay." "Okay. Night then." Ivy peered at her clock, the little white travel alarm Aunt Connie had given her so long ago. Both hands were aimed at the 12. She pulled her quilt closer and gazed into the green-lit darkness. She was slowly walking through Aunt Connie's living room in her mind, trying to calm herself by looking at everything. Brown velveteen sofa, dusty aloe plant, barrel of umbrellas by the door, dragonfly painting over the TV, dragonfly statuettes on the end table, 3 metal dragonflies that flew over the archway into the kitchen, when a car that needed a new muffler roared up the dirt road outside the farmhouse. It squealed into the driveway and brakes screeched. Ivy's eyes flew open. A few seconds later, someone was pounding at the kitchen door. Ivy threw her quilt back and Pup thumped to the floor and stalked away with his tail held straight and stiff. Prairie mumbled something and shoved herself upright. Downstairs, there was the low hum of Mom and Dad Evers' voices in counterpoint to the louder, faster sound of Ivy's mother's.
Great. Thank you so much. Ellen Aragood reading from The Education of Ivy Blake. So, Ellen, what are you working on now? What's the new project?
Right now, I'm working on another novel for adults, another literary fiction novel set in the UP. It's not a companion to South of Superior at all, but like South of Superior, it has a UP setting.
And this has been going on for a while?
This has been going on for, I kind of lose track of time, but I've been working on it for at least towards 3 years. Yeah, I'm not the quickest knife in the drawer.
If listeners are interested in finding out more information about you, they can go to your website.
Yes, ellenairgood.com.
They also can go to your Facebook page.
Yep, Ellen Aragood author.
Ellen Aragood, so glad that you're here. Thank you.
Thanks. It's fantastic to be here again.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm delighted to welcome Bill O. Smith and Glenn Wolf to Michigan Writers on the Air. Today we will be talking about a new picture book, 4 a.m., December 25th. The text is by Bill O. Smith and the illustrations are by Glenn Wolf. Bill O. Smith is the author of two other picture books, the best-selling Chickadees at Night and The Chickadee Spirit. Glenn Wolf, a celebrated artist, has worked in multiple genres, including book illustrations. He's collaborated with writer Jerry Dennis on a number of books, including It's Raining Frogs and Fishes and The Windward Shore. Bill, let's start with you. Who's the intended audience for this book?
I would call it more of a family book than a picture book. Of course, it's for young children, sights and sounds for a very young children, but for really understanding the book, four and up, it widens their world and deepens the meaning of Christmas. So, but it's a book to sit down with the family and go through. So I'd say the family, put your arm around your child and read it. That's the intended audience.
So it's really multiple generation.
Yeah, yes it is.
And where did the idea come from? What's the backstory?
I first of all wanted to honor my father. He was a World War II veteran who, he was one of those quiet heroes. He always told me he was stationed in Mitchell Field in New York. He was a weatherman, and not until he died a few years ago did I get a letter from one of his Air Force buddies who said, yes, we were at Mitchell Field, New York. Yes, he was a weatherman, but didn't he tell you that we flew in unarmed air patrols out of the Hebrides and Greenland and et cetera, et cetera? Very dangerous work. And I wanted to honor him. And so I wanted to come up with a story that did that. You're probably wondering what that has to do with a Christmas book.
It all fits together, having gone through the book several times, yes. And your collaboration with Glenn Wolf, how did that come about?
I, first of all, knew of Glenn's work, and I love his attention to detail. And this book, if you read the text of this book, which is only about 120 words, you would never know what the themes and the story is about. So much of the story is in the details. And as we all know, Glenn is wonderful at details and bringing out the story in a beautiful way. So he agreed, and here we are.
So Glenn, I want you to talk about the collaboration. Just as Bill said, the information in the illustrations goes way beyond the text. Is that from your imagination, or is that from the collaboration between the two of you?
I'd say the collaboration, and mainly Bill's vision. I mean, he really knew the story that he wanted to tell. He came in, you know, quite articulate about, you know, what he thought the illustrations could do. And the challenge for me was that when I illustrate a book, you know, like by author Jerry Dennis, it's about 80,000 words. This book had about 119, I think. So it really was Bill's kind of cinematic vision. You know, often when he would describe a drawing, it almost was like he was making a camera pan, you know, for a movie scene in a living room or something.
Yeah, I've always said a picture book is much closer to a movie than it is a novel. You have to think so visually, and Glenn's a wonderful collaborator in doing just that.
So can you talk about the process? I mean, writers go through multiple drafts. Did you do multiple sketches? How did this happen?
Multiple sketches. And we, you know, we'd start with sketches and then a small, almost like a flip book, a dummy of how those sketches would fit. You know, we knew pretty much the sequence and what the major theme of each one was, but then we just kept revising probably over a period of about 2 years of what and where went in each drawing and what got the most play, what was the focal point.
Yeah, that's the beauty of the book. The words sort of outline the theme of the book, but the illustrations really provide or back up the theme of the book.
Oh, thanks.
At the end of the book, Now, Bill, your old teaching days come through. At the end of the book, there is a page titled Extra Credit for the Extra Curious. Could you explain that to our listeners?
Yes. At the end, we go through, I wanted to send families back into the book. Hopefully, they would make new discoveries, see things they hadn't seen before. For instance, one of the extra credit questions is, how can changing a tire be a holy moment? And on just two pages of this book, there's a trucker trying to get home in South America, this one take. I should begin by saying the book takes the reader around the world to each continent and then comes back home to a town in the USA. And one of the places is South America, and there's a trucker trying to get home with his presents piled high in time, obviously, for his, well, you infer that, so he can spend Christmas. But then there's the immediate need of a pickup truck with a couple, and the woman is very pregnant. And he has to does he go home or does he meet the impulse to love, the immediate Christian need? And so, just in case people didn't see all of that going through it, I do try to send them back with several extra credit questions that will inspire family conversation, deepen the meaning of Christmas, add a little more hope and joy and love to the holiday.
And playing off that, at the end of the book, you've already mentioned it's dedicated to your father, but the dedication fits with the theme of the story. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Well, my father, as I said, he never mentioned to me. He was a quiet hero. When he was done with the war, he thought the heroes were buried overseas, and that was that. And he never defined himself. He was a man who's lived his life as a family man. He was a devout Christian. And he was just doing little things for people, unknown, anonymous things, good things. And so by dedicating it to him and to all who serve others with strength and kindness, whether they're famous or not famous, that's how I wanted to bring it all together in the book.
And this theme plays across the entire book. Every page, every illustration reinforces that. If listeners want to know more information about this book, they should go to your website.
BillOSmith.com.
And there's information on this book and your two previous books, and they can even listen to recordings of those. Beautiful website. And Glenn, your website is also equally rich.
Oh, thanks. GlennWolf.com and people can find me on the Facebook at Glenn Wolf Studio.
And I want to give a shout out to, I just want to reinforce them. What I say is, I could be Shakespeare, but this is a picture book. And without those beautiful illustrations, starting in the natural world and moving on to the human world, and where a soldier's coming home, and they're so evocative in the small visual details that add to the emotional details of the book. So thank you, Glenn.
Well, thanks.
And all profits from this book go to?
One of four veterans charities, one local one, the Cherryland VFW Relief Fund, which, although the VFW manages it, it is available to any veteran who has a need in the area. And then there are three national charities, which I chose from. I went to Charity Navigator and saw four-star charities, one that give 90% of their funds. And I wrote a real letter with a real stamp to all of them and said, if you're interested, please write me back. And the three that are listed wrote a real letter with a real stamp, and I'm a writer, and I like that kind of thing. And so And so did the VFW, and so they're the ones that reap all the profits.
Bill O. Smith, Glenn Wolfe, thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us, Aaron.
And the book again is?
4 a.m., December 25th.
Fleta Brown is here. Welcome, Fleta.
Hi, Aaron. I'd like to introduce you today to a writer I've known and read for years, although I haven't seen her for years. Her name is Margaret Gibson. Her newest book is Broken Cup from Louisiana State University Press. The poems all come from her watching the progression of her husband David's Alzheimer's disease. David was also a writer and poet. In the epigraph, she describes a Hindu teacher using the cup as metaphor. Over time, it stains, it might chip, but one can still drink from it. Eventually, it cracks, breaks, and no one can use it. The body is like that cup, he said, meaning the body-mind. But whatever you have drunk from the cup over the years, he said, that remains with you. The poems in this volume, as is true of all Gibson's poems, are rooted in daily life. Stones, a garden, the yard, a chair, a dog. I'm sure the word quiet has been used many times to describe her work, but I'd say quiet only in the sense that the poems aren't theatrical. They are so beautifully crafted, so simply said, that we feel we're in the presence of a kind of restraint, the kind that wisdom brings. Many of her poems are written as full sentences on the page, with a space between each one. It's the voice speaking, then considering, then speaking more. Parts 1 and 2 of the book are single, long poems, often separated, and this is interesting to me, by a small 4-dot square. It's a medieval system, you know, the mathematical system. A is to B, as, C is to D, and the 4 dots stands for as, which now, of course, we use an equal sign for. Section 3 intersperses her own writing with passages of her husband's work, another way of making love, she says in the poem. Here's a section from part 1, and I'll just pause where the symbol is placed. I grant you, it's terrible to lose one's mind as, burst of light by burst of light, the neurons misfire. Unable to reach across synapses, making run-on sentences, eroded fragments, tangles. In the metaphor of eclipse, the mind is shadowed. No ricochet of radiant protons graces its surface. Where did you grow up, you ask me? My story, you knew it once, yours too. Now you read your memoir, more moved than when you wrote it. The story's fresh, immediate, your depth of feeling no longer held in check by intellect. You read the sentences, your lifelines, amazed. Is it in your DNA, perhaps? A coded sentence. You will, like your mother before you, be asked to let go of all you hold dear. Our friend picks up his paintbrush. You put down your pen. Think of Sisyphus, condemned to accomplish nothing, sentenced to toil uphill to that resting place when the stone crests and settles, tilts and rolls down. What is in his mind at that moment? I keep wanting you to tell me what you remember, what you know and do not know, as the stone rolls, as the river flows, as the root sinks deeper, as is its way out of sight. Eclipsed, the moon goes dark, but the moon is still there, a deep presence held in place, disguised as an eddy in the river. These metaphors, I believe. Up, down, strange, charm, bottom, and top, hums the chorus in the background, as Oedipus, that beautiful man, snow-haired at Colonus, says openly, all is well. And you who were memory's scribe, this is now what you say. I have been lucky. I have been lucky all my life. So there's a flavor of Margaret Gibson's work, that restrained yet utterly open line and life. The poems feel generous to me. Then in part two of the book, there are more individual poems, each one focused on or triggered by a particular moment. I only have time to read one of these poems. This one is called Losing It. What little I know, I hold more dear now that I take the daily reinvention of loss as my teacher. I will never graduate from this college, whose MA translates Master of Absence, with a subtext in the imperative, misplace anything. If there's anything I want, it's that more people I love join the search party. You were the one renowned among friends for your luck in retrieving from the wayside the perfect bowl for the kitchen, a hand-carved deer, a pencil-drawn portrait of a young girl whose brimming innocence still makes me ache. Now the daily litany of losses goes like this. Do you have your wallet, keys, glasses, gloves, giraffe? Oh dear, I forgot my giraffe. That's the preferred response. But no, it's usually the glasses, the gloves, the wallet, the keys I've hidden. And when I get frantic, when I've lost my composure, my nerve, my compassion, I have only what little I know to save me. Here's what I know. It's not absence, I fear, but anonymity. I remember taking a deep breath, stopped in my tracks. I'd been looking for an important document I had myself misplaced, high and low. No luck yet. I was beside myself. So there may have indeed been my double running the search party. Stop, you said gently. I'll go get Margaret. She'll know where it is. But I'm Margaret, I gasped. No, no, you held out before me a copy of one of my books, pointing to the author's photograph. You know her, you said. We looked into each other's eyes a long time, the earth tilted on its axis, and what we were looking for, each other and ourselves, took the tilt, and we slid into each other's arms, holding on for dear life, holding on. It's so hard to read that poem. And notice it doesn't pull us by any gratuitous sentiment. It just tells it like it is, with the beautiful music of suffering and loss. This is Gibson's 11th collection of poems. They're very different, but each one has the same delicate lyricism and the same deep connection between our inner and outer selves. She's taught many places, but chiefly at the University of Connecticut. The poet is Margaret Gibson.
Thank you, Flita. Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. My thanks to Maureen Dumphy, Ellen Airgood, Billow Smith, Glenn Wolfe, and Flita Brown for their time. Also, kudos to Daniel Wanchura for his engineering and production work on the show. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next time to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, I wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.